afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another episode of the News in Review, a chance to reflect on the not usually good news of the past week. As always, I'm joined by my most excellent panel. From the City of Angels, we have psychologist, author, and teacher, Dr. Gary Penn. Gary, good to have you on board.
Simon, my pleasure. Hope all is well, and looking forward to today's show.
And also from the City of Angels, Ace Attorney. Some call him the Raymond Burr of the modern world, Peter Haven. Peter, great to talk to you again.
Well, thanks very much. It's good to be back. I've been tied up with a lot of stuff, and it's always good to be compared to Raymond Burr. Thank you very much.
This week we have a newcomer, and so I do hope everyone will treat him with love and kindness, but I kind of doubt it. From the Seattle area, teacher, author, and definitely politically minded, Matthew Hines. Matthew, have fun.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show. I feel, simply being a humble teacher, I feel I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. We have a psychologist and an attorney here.
Well, you have to have a psychologist and an attorney together. You know, I need them for one thing.
Yep. Can you imagine all the jokes coming out of this right now?
Actually, I can't. But how are things in Seattle? I love Seattle. What's going on? Let me guess.
Oh,
is it raining?
No. It's one of the odd days of the year. It's sunny, it's beautiful, and ready for the Seahawks to kick some 49er butt.
Boy, you Seattle guys, you sure love your Seahawks. That's for darn sure.
It's been a long time coming. I was in the sixth grade when the Seahawks started. And I've seen
a lot. Oh, you were back in the Jim Zorn days.
Exactly. Jim Zorn, Steve Largent, yeah.
Who was the coach back then?
That was Chuck Knox. I want to say Chuck Knox.
Chuck
was the
Norris?
First coach. I hope I'm right.
I think it was Chuck Knox. I think you're absolutely correct.
Okay. Yeah, he came up from the Rams.
Yeah, wow.
And our final panelist.
Sorry, Simon.
This week.
Simon's
going to want to
talk about cricket.
I hate cricket. From the Garden State, my good friend, Bill Conrad. Bill, welcome.
Thank you. I look forward to today's show. I guess it's a question of whose shoulders standing on whose. Sometimes we feel like our shoulders are being stepped on by the other panelists, but we forgive and we come back for the same behavior next week.
Oh, bullshit. You all fight like cats and dogs. Okay, so what happened this week? Nothing. Nothing happened. Well, okay, a couple of things happened. Well, let's kick off with the Republicans finally managing to reach an agreement and avoid a government shutdown. Which I think was unfortunate. Most government workers apparently are upset. Yeah, it would have been another 3-week paid vacation. Yeah, I seriously missed my calling by not becoming a government worker. Okay, they don't pay you, for the 3 weeks while you're on vacation, but you get a big fat paycheck afterwards. So, who to start with? Who to take on. Gary, what do you think about the fact that the Republicans actually managed to do something useful?
Well, first of all, someone's breathing very, very heavily, so it sounds like Darth Vader's on the line. So whoever that is, put your mouth away from wherever you're at. I'll tell you what, Simon, I'm very proud of myself. You want to know why? I told my wife that I wasn't going to cheat on her. So I just want you to know that. So
okay.
So I want you to know that this is what especially Congress, but especially the Republicans have come to, that if they don't just be complete douchebags, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you want to give them like a Tootsie Roll, like for brushing your teeth or something. It's gotten so absolutely pathetic. And the bar has become so low that the people are, like, happy that they didn't do something absolutely insane. It's pretty disgusting.
Matthew,
no kudos for me at all, obviously.
Right.
Go ahead.
And so, Matthew, you're the new kid on the block. What are your thoughts?
I'm not a Republican or a Democrat, and the reason for that is that I don't see the difference between the two. And I might come across as quite skeptical about things. I don't know about your other panelists here, but I have a book out. I assume your other panelists do. But I'm the author of a book called Deceptions of the Ages, Mormons, Freemasons, and Extraterrestrials. And I'm sorry about this plug, but the things that I talk about, you really have to read that book because there's a lot of history involved here. And I'm not going to come out and make some, you know, brash statements without having something to back it up with. And I'll just point out, just for to be the gadfly on the wall here, and to defend our great representatives in the Congress, is it really their fault that they're there trying to get nothing? And the only way they can get reelected is if they get their face plastered on the TV, and that costs a lot of money. So the only thing that they can do from the time they hit the, you know, the tarmac there in D.C. is to start campaign, you know, raising or fundraising. And what scares me the most about the whole thing is that they keep passing these laws that keeps making the contributors more and more anonymous. And so what we're having now is we're basically the danger of any democracy, if you go all the way back to ancient Greece and the Republic of Rome, is that, you know, eventually you get these outside powers that pay for the government. And I'm afraid that the way that they're passing these laws now, that I'm afraid that, that there's so much foreign capital, and with our deficit and all that, most of our representatives are doing nothing but they're worried about raising the funds. Now, what about the American people? They don't do anything. I mean, come on, they just passed the immigration thing, and people, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I understand how the Constitution works. Obama can't pass a law, but he did. Now, how did he do that? Who's going to fund that? You know, now the Republicans made a big stink about it, but somebody's going to have to pay for that. So, and the Republicans will. And can I? And I'll give up the whole seat here, but I'll just make an example. In when they tried to pass the GATT back in the 90s, I wrote a letter. I was living in Alaska. I wrote a letter to Frank Murkowski and said, please do not pass the GATT. He wrote back and said, well, we voted no, but they had a rules thing that ended up passing anyway. So the world that was created out of that is the world that you see now. And you know, a lot of people said we don't want that, but it was a trick. So that's what I think. It's all about the money. And if you want to see more about where the money comes from, that's in my book.
Right. And Peter, lots of food for thought there.
Yeah, I guess so. I think that it's just politics as usual, fighting and squabbling until the 11th or the 11th hour and 59 minute, and then they they come to some sort of compromise. What did they do? Pass some sort of trillion-dollar bill? Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, and, well, actually, $1.1 trillion.
$1.1. Well, that's good. I'm not even sure what that means. What does that mean, a $1.1 trillion bill? They're going to be spending $1.1 trillion? I don't know. It just seems so utterly and completely beyond my control or my grasp to think of these kinds of numbers and figures. And, they didn't shut down. God knows when the next threatened shutdown will occur, but I'm sure there'll be another one.
Simon?
Yes.
Simon, this is Matt. Can I ask something?
Sure.
How many of the people on this panel voted in the last election?
Okay. I'll go first. I live in Mississippi. I lean left, and my vote basically would have done nothing more than to help destroy rainforests. I don't count.
I'm sorry. Sorry, your vote boiled down to that.
Yeah. If I was in California, yeah, I'd probably get my lazy butt off the couch and go vote. But now, pointless in Mississippi.
Maybe that's another show.
Oh
yeah, we should have a show about Mississippi.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be a burning issue.
Right,
that one?
Right. So, does anyone else want to step up to the plate and answer Matt's question?
And if the question is, did I vote in the last election, the answer is no.
Why not?
California's a blue state, and that's how I lean, and it was clearly going to vote for Obama. And that was fine by me, and nothing else really struck me as all that. It didn't motivate me to go to the polls, let's put it that way.
can I
How about you, Gary?
Oh.
Gary? Pick yourself up off the floor.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm a little puzzled as to the question. I vote, of course. I vote. So why the question?
Well,
I mean, how is that going to inform what you have to say here?
Well, Simon, can I answer that since it was my question?
Oh, absolutely, Matthew. This is a free-for-all.
Well, because I believe in, actions speak louder than words, and everybody badmouths the government. But, we live in a democracy, and a lot of people died. So, we just have to go and drive to you can just mail in a ballot now, I guess. Anyway, a lot of people died, so we could have that. And I don't mean to sound like, one of these, some crazy person, but this is a government, and I lived for 13 years in Saudi Arabia and Oman, and those people can't vote. Everything is basically handed to them, and they're told how to live and all that. And so when I came home, and I've always voted, but I should also add that I also spent 4 years as a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne when I was 18. I think that if you live in a democracy, you should, pay some homage to the people that gave you these privileges. And as crazy as that sounds, that is the biggest problem of all. And that's why you have this country is controlled by so few people, because they always know that the poor people, and this is history, and this is why I keep referring back to my book, poor people don't do anything about
it. Wait a minute. You wrote a book?
Yeah, I never heard that before. Actually, we're already 5 minutes into the program.
No way, I did not know that.
Yes. You know, the biggest problem that we have is not that people don't vote. The biggest problem that we have, there's a couple big problems. One of them is gerrymandering, and the other one is money and politics. It's become an exception. And the third problem we have is that we're a very stupid country, and stupid people vote for stupid politicians. So we could have everyone vote, and you could have everyone in Mississippi, everyone in Arkansas, everyone in Alabama. They're going to vote for Louis Gohmert. And so what you're going to do is you're going to have millions of people vote for the Louis Gohmerts of the world. You're going to have millions of people vote for people who think that the world is 6,000 years old, people in Kentucky who go to the Creationist Museum who think that the world's 6,000 years old. And that's what's going to happen. So you're going to have that. So it's not, you know, to have such a simplistic statement is because people don't vote. You know, what you can do is I could put $15 billion into an election and make every other candidate but mine sound like a homosexual prostitute and have the Louis Gohmerts of the world get elected. And these yahoos are going to do it. So the problem with our democracy is so multi-tiered, is so complex, is so incredibly problematic. It's like saying to a cancer patient, you got to lose 10. It's an issue, but it's not the issue.
Matthew, you started this with your question. Have you had enough, or are you up for round two?
Well, I'm always up for a good intellectual joust, if you don't mind me borrowing that from jolly old England. Still, though, I don't agree with this idea that because I don't agree with the system, I'm affecting it somehow positively by not voting in it. You're just basically telling, and the person who just spoke. I just sent a blog to some that I put out today, and it says exactly what you're saying. And this is what happens. The money who can get all these stupid people who are manipulated by advertising, they can tell them how to vote, and that's how the system works. And they muddy the waters with so many non-significant issues, and then this is what we have. So, you know, but if people were more involved in the process, I don't think that we'd have this. And, you know, and I'd just like to say this to defend our representatives, although I have just as low of opinion of them as anybody else. But if people said to them when they come home, I will support you, I voted for you, and I'll back you up 100% on anything you want to do in D.C., and if they come out with some crappy news and they try to slander you because you don't vote for this thing, I'll stick with you. We've got your back. And if we told our representatives that when they went to Washington, D.C., instead of we're going to fire you because we agree with all this crap we hear on the news, then, you know, I can't blame them for what they do. I really can't.
And Peter, you spent a couple of years on Capitol Hill as an aide or assistant or something.
All three of the above.
Right.
Aid, assistant, or something. I'm still trying to figure it out.
Right. You know, you must have got the sense that Washington is disengaged from the real world. And you know,
yeah.
How on earth does Washington get the common man back in the fray?
Well, I don't know how it really does that. My perspective on Washington is that I worked for a member of the House of Representatives, and when you represent a smaller constituency within a state, I think you tend to be a little bit more directly connected to that constituency as opposed to being a senator representing an entire state. But either way, I think, you know, most of what members of Congress are doing are dealing with matters that directly help their constituents or basically directly help themselves by, you know, staying in office. And that generally speaking, that's the way elected officials operate most of the time. And the only time that really changes is when there's some sort of dramatic uproar or dramatic event that sort of galvanizes attention on what they're doing, and then there tends to be a kind of unanimity to achieve something. But those moments are few and far between, in my opinion, and in between those moments, it's politics as usual. It's politicians doing what they can to promote their own reelection and also help out with what they perceive to be the most important needs of their constituents, regardless of how those needs affect, you know, the nation as a whole or the world as a whole.
You might be referring to pork here. Things like the bridge
you can
to
call
nowhere.
It pork. You can call it pork. You can call it other things. You know, it's responsiveness to constituent needs. You know, for instance, if you're in Michigan and you have an automotive industry, you know, that's where your needs are going to be aligned. If you're in the Midwest and you have a lot of farming constituents, that's where you're going to try to you know, help out. And if you're in places like North Carolina and you have a huge tobacco industry, you know, that's where you're going to be responsive to, in my opinion. And generally speaking, that's the way it works, unless there's some sort of, you know, big issue about something that galvanizes everyone's attention, gets everyone focused. Oh my God, what's Congress going to do about this issue? And then everybody looks to see what you're going to say or do. And in those particular moments, people tend to align and have a kind of unified approach.
And that's, Simon, can I jump in?
Sure.
Who makes the decision to put the highlights on these people? Now, can we all agree that this is that, you know, there's a network, and that network is owned by somebody, and they decide who is focused on and who is rewarded and who is punished? Who makes those decisions as to who gets focused on? It's the money.
Well,
correct?
If you're talking about focused on day-to-day affairs, I think that you're right. There are various networks and various agendas and various perspectives, and we've talked about them before. Some are right-wing and conservative. Some are left-wing and liberal. Some are supposedly, you know, more center of the aisle. But what I'm talking about are some sort of national issue or event that cuts across all those lines, and it transforms the nation's focus. And it doesn't. That's not a function, in my opinion, of any kind of particular agenda or something. That just happens. And everyone focuses on it. For example, something like the 9/11 attacks. You know, after that happened, the nation became galvanized in a certain sense, and everyone's focus was on a certain issue, and it was the issue. And you know, that everybody had a response to it. You know, bumper stickers came out, and they said, "You just tell me where to go, Mr. President, and I'll start killing people." You know, you know, these colors don't run or something like that. Flags everywhere. I mean, every now and then, every few years, there's something that galvanizes attention and scrutiny. And then there's something of a consensus. And sometimes it's mob rule. Sometimes it's mob rule. Sometimes it's clearer than that. But when I'm talking about something like that, I'm talking about something that cuts across the ability of things like media with points of view to manipulate what gets focus and what doesn't. There are some things that just blow all the lid off of all of that.
Well, can I ask this? Have you heard of the thing called Plato's allegory of the cave?
Yes, you look at a cave, you see shadows. People think the shadows are real, but really it's just shadows of light from something else. And to be perfectly honest with you, other than that, I really never quite understood it, except that you were looking at shadows when we should be looking at the real thing. Perhaps you can enlighten us and shed some light on this.
Well, that's kind of what actually that's what my whole book, Deceptions of the Ages, is about, how people that have the money to manipulate our information do so, and we are taught to think about everything from, and I use the examples of Mormons, because everybody has a preconceived notion of them, extraterrestrials, and Freemasons, because these are three things that people have all these misconceptions about.
What's your position on extraterrestrials? I'm kind of curious about that.
I just knew this was going to come up.
I have a deep and abiding interest in matters relating to space and the cosmos, and I'm fascinated by it. I'm just curious.
I just got to know the name of the book because I'm trying to write it down. Could someone please give it to me, please?
Deceptions of the Ages.
Uh-huh. Who's the publisher?
Hindsight Press.
Okay, thank you very much. I've got to tweet that to all my followers. Thank you.
Okay.
Continue.
Now, as far as the extraterrestrials go, I really am not going to say anything about it because I would get off into a whole different tangent, and Simon would probably hunt me down.
Oh, I think it's as good a topic as any. We could spend 5 minutes on it. What about the search for life elsewhere? What are your thoughts? You got a book title that has that in it, so you got to have 5 minutes worth of a point of view there. I mean, let's have some fun.
Well, all I'm going to do is I'm going to tease you, and I'm going to get your appetite wet for this, and you're going to go away cursing me because you're going to go, "Oh, why didn't he tell me?" There is a huge connection between extraterrestrials, Freemasons, and Latter-day Saints, and because people are taught. Like Mormons, well, what are they? They wear funny underwear, and they have 12 wives and all that. And that's the only people know about them. Well, they don't know the whole deal. And if they did know the whole deal, they might have a whole different opinion. And then they might go, well, why am I told all this misinformation about these people? And I'm also just told this information about extraterrestrials. Or have
well,
them.
I'm glad you mentioned the link between extraterrestrials and Freemasons, because I think I had heard something about that before. So without going into the whole tripartite relationship, we'll leave the Latter-day Saints off. We'll review that in the book. But just help me again. What was the link? Because I did see a show once that talked about that Freemason extraterrestrial connection, and I just forget what it was. Just real briefly, what's the link? The Freemasons were sort of put here by extraterrestrials or something. They're sort of superiors or something.
You've seen the. What is it, Indiana Jones? What's the last one, the skull?
The skull. That was the crystal skull. That was a really good one.
Okay. Now, and I am not answering your question here. I'm just...
I'm a lawyer. Nobody ever answers my questions. It's an occupational hazard. I'm in a trial for a whole week. I don't think anybody answered a single question.
Yeah, I should have pointed this out before we went on air. As a lawyer, do not expect Peter to answer anything directly.
No, I'm testifying now in the form of a question, which is what I've been doing all week long in trial anyway, to my complete and utter futility. But help me out here. Crystal Skull, Indiana Jones, Freemason, extraterrestrials, I'm with you. Let's just keep going with this just for a few more minutes, please.
Knowledge was their treasure. That's the line in there, and that's what sums it up right there. And other than that, that's all I'm going to say about the Freemasons. But in my book, I go back to I go all the way back to the biblical references to things like Adam and Tubal Cain and Freemasonry and the Bible. And I cover the whole spiel all through history in the book, because what I do is I develop an argument that takes a pretty long time to prove. But that's it. That's all I would answer.
Well, where does Chariots of the Gods fit in all of this? Just briefly, you're building on that doctrine, I take it.
You know, if you, I'm gonna.
Peter, you got to do me a favor, You got to let this go. Peter, do me a favor.
I'm good.
Okay. I'm sorry. I do find it interesting. Forgive me. Back to the news and review.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think this is great because, you know, the problem is that Gary sometimes goes out on tangents and we just let him go. But now if we can get Matthew to include Republicans in this group of extraterrestrials, it explains a lot, and, you know, it gives us so much more to talk about, and I look forward to that. So, Matthew, going.
Fine, I stand corrected. I'm going to shut up. I'm going to be quiet. Fine.
Well, Gary's right. I've gone too far afield. It's time to get back to the reality. I my head is in the cosmos too much. I need to get back down to Earth. So where were we?
Who the hell knows? But it
Republicans,
sure was,
apathy, voting. You know,
yeah,
we got problems afoot.
Yeah, all of the above. I see a huge amount of apathy, and.
Yes,
you know,
that's true, and that's what we've talked about. And how do we get elected officials back to, you know, the common man? And I guess my response to that is I don't think that's likely. And you know, one solution is I need to vote. Another solution is I don't know what another solution is. I really don't. I truly do not.
All right. Peter, we have talked about this several times before. I am not a constitutional historian. However, everything I've ever read about the subject is that, you know, if you become a senator or a representative, you are doing it because you care for the country, not for the money. And that's where I think the whole system is going wrong. It was mentioned earlier, you know, people get elected and the first thing they do is start their next campaign to get re-elected. I don't think was the idea that the founding fathers have. Would you disagree, Peter?
When you say disagree, you mean disagree with the concept that elected officials were supposed to be paid for their services, or what exactly? I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow that.
Okay, sorry, I didn't put it in legalese.
No, you probably did.
Okay. My theory is that elected officials should work for absolute minimum wage, and they should do it because they love their country, not because they can make $180,000 a year and get $1 million a year in perks. Does that state it more clearly?
Well, I think that the Constitution has within its framework that everyone who's an elected official in the federal government will be compensated, including the president and the elected officials. I think the purpose and intent behind the Constitution was to achieve precisely what I believe it has achieved, which is a certain measure of responsiveness to local constituents, however local constituents are defined. And I think to a certain extent, it has achieved that. Elected officials are, by constitutional design, supposed to be responsive to the needs of their constituents, or they risk losing their seats, losing re-election. I think there are other factors that come into play because, you know, in the modern world, there are too many special interests at work in the modern government, and too much of it goes on without anybody really paying much attention to it. But generally speaking, elected officials do have to keep their constituents happy as best they can, or they're not going to keep their seats. And that more or less is what happens. I certainly more so in the House of Representatives, I think, than the Senate. But that is the purpose and intent behind the Constitution. I think it gets distorted in the modern world, but that's what they tried to achieve, in my opinion.
Gary, do you think it's reasonable that you can have someone only work for 113 days a year, and you, the taxpayer, are paying them $180,000 plus the million or so that go to their hangers-on?
That doesn't bother me, Simon. It really doesn't. You know, what bothers me, I think people who go into politics, a lot of people, you know, especially if you want the citizen, you know, legislator, if they're a carpenter or they're a teacher or they're just a school teacher or something like that, they can't afford to have a home in D.C. They can't afford to have a home in D.C. and they can't afford to have, you know, a home in their home state and so forth. So I don't mind them getting paid. What I do mind is they've done studies that people who come into Congress and their net worth is maybe $100,000 or $200,000 a year, they leave Congress millionaires because they get the lowdown on investment strategies, and they all leave millionaires. And then everyone talks about it, and of course no one does it because they're the ones who are making the laws. They become lobbyists. So what happens is you become like Eric Cantor, who gets voted out of office, and he probably made $180,000 a year. And now he's in Wall Street, and he's probably going to make seven figures, mid seven figures, high seven figures. So I don't mind, Simon, if that, to me, that's not the problem. If you get elected, Simon, if you run for Congress in Mississippi, then there's some miracle happens, and you know, they count the votes wrongly, And you get elected, I want you to get paid. I have no problem with you getting paid. That doesn't bother me. What bothers me is you're going to leave a millionaire, and then someone's going to hire you from some Keystone Pipeline that's going through Mississippi as a consultant, which obviously is a bribe for your vote while you're in Congress. And the system is completely broken. That's the problem. I don't want to weed whack on these problems. If we have any chance of saving our democracy, we really have to get to the root, not just the weed.
The chances of me getting elected would hinge on me being able to part the Red Sea Bayou, of which I think is pretty unlikely. Bill, you've been very quiet, the thinker. Weigh in.
Okay. I can see that this is a whole broken system in the whole election, getting into office, leaving, and now you become involved in advocating all the things that you wanted to do and couldn't get through at the time. You get the right financial backing and you go through it. The FDA has a program that they try to keep the salaries up so that their food inspectors don't get bribed by the companies they're reviewing and investigating to make sure that everything is safe coming out. But at the end, even the FDA people become rich, and after they leave the FDA, they're making a boatload more money because they've started working for the companies that are corrupt. So, you know, the problem is we've set up a model to get us through this, but the model doesn't work anymore. So how do you fix that? I don't really have an answer, but it seems like you need the right kind of oversight to make sure that the corruption doesn't take over. The problem is that every time we introduce oversight, we're paying people exorbitant salaries to watch people who are corrupt, and they make even more money oversighting, involved in oversight of these programs. So how do you fix that? Because we see that there's a problem. We're just clueless when it comes to coming up with an answer.
Okay. Yep.
Simon, can I jump in here?
Sure.
I'll confess, I'm a history teacher, and I have a lifelong love of history and politics and all of that. So I'd like to just jump in and talk about this idea of, Simon, you talked about what the founding fathers had in mind. And whenever I hear that, like a porcupine, my bristles go up, because it's usually some corporation telling you that how good small government is until they want a handout, and then, you know, you don't hear that argument anymore. But the idea the founding fathers had, remember, is that they had just fought a war with your country. What country is that?
No,
it was
Croatia.
That's right. So anyway, they had an idea of a small government that basically they, as far as I understand it, and I studied constitutional law at Washington State University, and so as far as I understand, their what they wanted was a government, at least some of them just wanted a government they could pass some laws and go back to their farms and not worry about the government coming with troops and taking their farms and doing whatever else a big government does when they want to start to collect taxes. But what they created was a revolving document that would continue to change. And the only problem that happened today and what we hear today is that I'm disenfranchised, I'm so disenchanted with the system, is that document is not going to work anymore, because people have to make it work themselves. And once the people start throwing up their arms and saying it's no good, because people need to get together and make decisions together that everybody agrees with, and not rich people telling poor people this is how it's going to be, which is just what we have now. So when people, or if people will get together and say, yes, we're going to, this is a different society, and we do need to make changes, and we're going to get together and agree on things, and we're going to go into the next, into the future together as a people. But we don't have that. We have rich people telling us in the future we're all going to be divided by race. And that's just how it's going to be. And that's all I see. And when I listen to all this talk about the government, well, it's not the government. You know, the government's the people. So maybe the people are the problem.
Good point. I want to move on and talk about something else. The fabled CIA torture report that was released this week. It's not clear to me who was right and who was wrong. Actually, the bigger question is, does anyone care? Now, one of the reasons I invited Matthew to the program was that right in the middle of the Iraq conflict, he was fed up with the rain and cold of Seattle, and moved to Oman to do some teaching. And later on, Saudi Arabia. This was right at the time of the Gulf War. Things were probably fairly icky. Would I be... correct in that statement, Matthew?
I need to back up a little bit. I actually went to Oman right after September 7th, and I went to Oman after September 11th because I didn't buy into 9/11 at all, and I had known, as I said, I'd been in the 82nd Airborne. I'd served time in the Middle East as part of the peacekeeping force in the Sinai, and I had a lot of friends that were Arabs in college, and I just didn't think that those people that you know, they said that had done 9/11 were even at all capable of carrying it out themselves. So from the beginning, I just thought, well, they're going to really start a war. Basically, we took over the war that another country has continued to fight for 40 years. We basically took over that war for them. And I just said, this isn't really right that we're going to vilify this a whole race of people because these, you know, whatever these people are up to, whatever reasons they did this, I didn't think that was right. So I said, I got on a plane. I took a job teaching in Oman. And actually, I found Oman to be a quite peaceful paradise. It was had nothing to do with the war on terror, and the people there were fantastic. And my two of my books about the Middle East are about living in Oman and having a fantastic time at a time when they were telling the American public how horrible the Middle East is. And at the whole time, except if you're in the places where Americans are bombing and killing people, most other places were actually very nice, and people are just trying to make a living and raise their kids, and it's just like here, except for Muslim. And I just like to also add that I'm not trying to say that I'm against this war on terror, because it did bring stability to some of these governments in the region, and it has allowed a prosperity that would not have been allowed if Saddam Hussein had been allowed to keep in power. However, with the technology we had after 9/11, we could have just gone in with a few guys and taken out Osama bin Laden. We could have gone in with a force or whatever, or done something and taken out Saddam Hussein. We have the technology to do that, but we had to spend trillions of dollars to fight a war and create what's basically a failed state, and nobody wants to take any responsible for that now. But the American public, once again, is dumped with the bill and all the suffering.
Right. Peter, I'm going to ask you, have you read or at least, read the encapsulated report released on CIA torture?
I've read articles that discuss it, and so I have a preliminary understanding of it. I think everyone has a preliminary understanding of it, and my understanding is that immediately after 9/11, in an attempt to gather information, the CIA under the Bush administration engaged in what the report calls extensive and abuse of torture as a means of interrogation to try to get information.
No, it's enhanced interrogation techniques.
Okay, enhanced interrogation techniques.
And,
you know, there are various people who are quoted as, harshly criticizing this use of these, aggressive interrogation techniques. And, I don't really know what to say about it. Obviously, it sounds awful. It struck me as precisely what I was talking about before, which is there was this huge traumatic experience, and I think that there was a tremendous overreaction to it. I'm curious to hear what Matthew was just talking about, which is to say that we had the ability to just go in and surgically take out Osama bin Laden, and I guess I'm just curious, if I understand correctly, we didn't do that because there was a whole lot of money at stake by waging a war. Is that what I understood you to say, Matthew?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. That's not the first time I've heard that theory. I don't know how to do it. I know that, my own personal opinion is that Cheney and his businesses profited tremendously by these international wars on terror. I just don't know. We talk about feeling disenfranchised. I'm just a little guy in the world. I have no idea how much of any of this is accurate or inaccurate, is a political hatchet job or reality. And I don't know what on earth I could possibly do about it. It reminds me of when I lived overseas in Australia. I studied in Australia for a year after working on the Hill. And, as an American living overseas in Australia, and this was back in the Reagan administration, I had a lot of people come up to me and they would express their concerns and their anger and their frustrations with America. And, I would sit here and I'd listen to these things and I would just say to myself, I have no idea what I can do about any of this. And after listening to this for a year, I used to joke with people. I used to pull out a notepad and I'd flip open, and when I'd sit at a lunch table and people would have concerns and their problems about America, I would say, okay, let me write this down, and I promise you when I get back, I'm going to sit down with the president and I'm going to work this all out. I mean, what can I possibly do?
Could I speak as a psychologist real quickly?
Please.
The thing about big, tough, strong America is we're very paranoid and we're really terrified of getting sick, and we have sanitary wipes for the carts at the supermarket, and we use antibacterial to such a degree that we're ruining our immune system. So, there are so many areas where we're just absolutely broken. The idea of the overreaction to 9/11 is just it's going to go down on the ash heap of history. As far as the money goes, I think it was hubris. I think it was narcissism. I think it was arrogance on the American part. The genesis of going into the Middle East, of taking over Iraq, was in the 1990s with Bill Kristol and Dick Cheney, the new American century. It was a wet dream that the American right, the neocons, had. And that was the beginning of it. And so, when you read, I think it was Jane Risen wrote a book called The 99% Solution or Problem, where Dick Cheney's position after 9/11 was, if there's a 1% chance that someone's going to go after us, we have to kill them. And it's such incredible paranoia. It's such a guillotine for a headache. And you know what? Everyone will give you a reason for doing what they do. So on one hand, you have America, which is so scared. We're scared. We're just scared shitless. We're scared. We're terrified of the Mexicans coming over. We're terrified of a black president. We're terrified of this. We're terrified of education. And we're terrified of science. And then all of a sudden, you have something happens, and instead of just doing what's appropriate after 9/11, special ops, strategic strikes, taking out the people who killed us, not nation-state politics. It was a neocon wet dream. It was set up perfectly. As far as the torture goes, it was horrible. But you know what's more torturous? To send a Tomahawk missile into a neighborhood. But yes, these people, I said this from the very beginning. George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, all these guys should be in The Hague on war crimes. There are no difference.
Yes,
anyone,
absolutely.
Peter, you could tell me this. You tell me the difference between George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Milosevic. We have 200,000 innocent Iraqis dead, right? 200, for no reason. For absolutely no reason. So I want you to tell me, why did Milosevic die, in The Hague? And why is Dick Cheney, and why is George Bush painting his stupid paintings and going on these shows with that shit-eating grin that he has, like he's some kind of genius? It makes me sick to my stomach. It makes me ashamed to be an American that this is what's going on.
Simon,
okay.
Can I jump in here?
Sure.
Simon?
Yep.
Yeah, I just want to say, I'm very quick. I want to say, first of all, to the, I think it's Gary, the attorney, I think. You were in Australia. I was in Oman during the Iraq attack. And so I was working with Iraqis. And I had one group of Iraqis who were pro, who said, can't wait for you, me, to get in there and get to Saddam. And then I had other people that I worked with, specifically a woman who was able to travel in and out of Iraq freely because her family had connections with Saddam. So obviously when Iraq happened, she was all over me. And that's what my second book called, Another Year in Oman, Between Iraq and a Hard Place, is about that invasion and what it was like to be the single American in a small Middle Eastern town trying to teach when everybody's looking at you, like you're crazy. And as far as this Bush thing goes, what frightens me, Simon, is that, and I think it was Bill in New Jersey that was just talking, I agree with you 100%, war criminals, some of the worst in history, and they're talking about running Jeb Bush for president. So that is what I wrote a blog about that today because I'm really terrified. And if that happens, then there's really no more hope for the U.S. I don't think, unless they run Satan against him or something. I don't think Satan would even run against a Bush.
Okay, I'm going to switch gears completely. The idea of Jeb Bush running for president makes me go all flaccid.
He's backed by Satan. Satan's supporting him. That's a tough guy to beat in an election. Trust me.
But
I think Satan has principles. I'm going to argue that.
Good for you, Matthew.
But even Democrats, Hills for president, another 8-year stay at the White House.
Well, I do think that just as the stock market tends to be forward looking, reactions in the stock market today oftentimes reflect people's perceptions of what's coming down the road financially. I also think that sometimes the political temperature is forward-looking, and I believe that the recent change in the makeup of Congress is to a certain degree a function of the forward-looking nature of the American political landscape. And I think people are foreseeing they're foreshadowing a Republican in the White House because I do think that most people think that the Democrats are going to nominate Hillary, and I think that many people think that she can't be elected. So I think that we're seeing a foreshadowing of a Republican in the White House in the next presidential election, and I don't know who it's going to be. Maybe it will be Jeb Bush. I don't know. But it causes me just as much as many concerns as have already been expressed. But I think that's where we're going.
Hey, Bill, you live in New Jersey. There's many rumors that your governor might run if he slims down enough to fit through the doorways of the White House. What are your thoughts?
I know he's had surgery and he is supposedly dropping pounds. I don't know. I don't like him as a governor. I think that as a Republican, he's got this great hidden agenda, and it's not there to help the common people. So for a candidate, no. I'm afraid of him, and I think the problem is that there's an awful lot of Republicans in like Texas and Ohio that think he's doing such a fantastic job when he's not. He has the controversies and issues come up, and he has a way of just burying them and
Even if they become very national news, he's able to pretend like it's not a big deal and it's not very important. So
that's
think,
what politicians do, Bill. That's what they do. And I think that you have a very up close and good perspective on Christie because he's in your neighborhood. And I think that these other political figures that people talk about, their local people feel similarly about them as well because they have a closer perspective on them. And it's just, you know, it's just one of the flaws with the political process, you know, regardless, you know, the there's a problem with candidates. There just is.
No, we need better candidates because none of them are the real McCoy. There's always bad skeletons in the closet. It isn't little skeletons anymore. It's always bad skeletons.
Yeah, I got skeletons, but mine are good. They're nice.
Cool.
you take them out and polish them every day.
They're happy skeletons. They're nice. They're like Tim Burton Nightmare Christmas skeletons. You know, you kind of want to play with them. They're fun.
Okay. And by the way, Matthew, Seattle is winning 3-0.
Yay. Should be more than that, but good. Thank you.
That's okay. Don't worry. Don't worry, Matthew. The 49ers are driving, and they're in Seattle territory.
Well, it doesn't matter. 49ers don't stand a chance.
And
they're
they just got
house.
A first down.
You know, I can't watch the game because I'm doing this, and my wife is such a Seattle fan, she won't let me do both at the same time. So,
it's okay, Matthew. They're at the 20 now. I'll keep you posted.
Thank you.
It's one of the services that we offer. You know, if anything serious happens in the game, you'll be the first to hear.
Hey, it's first and 10
at the
20.
Well, my wife will come in and tell me.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to the plot.
So, Simon, can I bring up again to you know, get the you know, discussion going about this torture? Why is it? Do you remember when the U.S. invaded Iraq that they were showing dead Americans on Al Jazeera or something, and the U.S. and this is kind of to agree with, I think it was Bill in New Jersey, the United States raised a huge you know, ruckus about, oh, this is a violation of the Geneva Convention to show a dead person or a prisoner. But when the United States violates the Geneva Convention, nobody says a thing, and they've been doing it for years. And so, yeah, I agree with this. That you know, and Simon, I know we've kind of jokingly talked about me running for president, but I ran it by my Facebook friends. They said no, they said you're too good for that. So I think I might have to defer on it. But anyway, I would run only because I don't think there's anybody else worth voting for. But anyway. As far as the torture goes, I just don't understand why when the United States does it, nobody says anything. But when somebody else does it, then the United States is the first one to accuse people of doing it.
Well, we just published a whole report outing ourselves. So, you know, we're talking about it now because now there's a big report, you know, detailing all this. Now, whether the report is an expose or a political hatchet job or both, which is what I suspect. But, you know, it comes out.
What you have to understand, Peter, is the Republican Party of today, there are reports about climate change. And the Republican Party will say, well, no, we don't believe in climate change. And
yeah.
So the report could say, the statistics could say healthcare is going down, the healthcare costs are going down, better results. The Republicans will say, well, we don't believe in that. And then you have a situation where there's
the situation with torture. And we say, well, you know what? There's all this torture, and the Republicans simply are expert. They are so good. They're very sociopathic these days, and you have to understand that. The sociopath can could sit there and pass every lie detector test.
Yeah.
And what they will do is they will look at you in the eye, and they will know what's going on, and they will simply say, no, there's not a problem here. There's no there. There's nothing. The Republican Party of today is a bunch of sociopaths. And, yes, you may find one or two good ones, one or two decent ones, but they are so far between. There's so few of them.
Yeah.
And when someone says, when Matt says that there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, to me, that's just absolute lunacy. I am not saying that the Democratic Party is this incredible party, that there's not a ton of problems. But like I've said 1,000 times, if I have 2 glasses of wine with my meal and you have a jug of wine, we are both not drinkers. And the Republican Party is a dangerous party that needs to be destroyed for the 100th time, because they are a bunch of cultists. And all they believe about is simply they just follow their leader. Their leaders, their cult leaders of Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham and all these people, and they don't think. They simply don't think. They are believers. They're believers of religion, and they're believers of Sean Hannity, and there's no thought there.
Can I jump in?
Simon,
Sure.
Can I jump in on this?
Somebody
Matthew, have we ever refused you once when you say, can I jump in?
Okay.
Jump on
no,
in.
No, that's what I mean,
you're the most polite person on the panel.
This is a great minds think alike moment. But that's Bill in New Jersey, right?
Okay.
Yep.
This is about
is that Bill?
Behind torture. Okay. The reason behind torture, according to the CIA, is that is this a ticking bomb incident? For instance, let's just say one of our loved ones, and maybe it's even closer to home with Simon, because he's out there in the media and the publicity. What if one of his family members is kidnapped and potentially is going to go through the same situation where the reporters have been kidnapped, they probably get tortured. We're not 100% sure. Our assumption is that they are. And how is Simon going to feel about a loved one getting kidnapped? Isn't he going to want to have the military, who might have captured someone that was involved in the kidnapping, wouldn't he want some way to figure out how to extract the information from this person? And if they were going to torture that person to get that information, he would probably be in favor of that. Now, it's just my assumption. So the question is, if you go back to 2002, I think his name was Jacob von Metzler or something like that. Remember, he got kidnapped. He was an 11-year-old. And what the Germans, I'm pretty sure it was the Germans, they did is that they tortured one of the subjects who was involved in the kidnapping of him, and they tortured him, and within 10 minutes of torture, the guy divulged the location of the boy. So they went after him, but the boy was already dead. So the question becomes, is there a certain number of people's lives that are in jeopardy in which torture is acceptable, or are we doing a discredit because we're not doing everything in our power to try to rescue that one person, that small community of people, or a London or New York City? How do you make that justification? Because it seems to me that we're doing a disjustice if we are not trying to use everything in our means to find that person. Additionally, if you can't stop that, is the person you're torturing just going to give you false information, which is going to lead you astray, and London's still going to blow up?
those are the kinds
Bill, you make a determination by a government. You can't make that determination because you're too involved. It has to be a situation of how nations operate in the world. And so if you say, if my daughter or if my wife, would you do this? It's not for me to answer. I'm against the death penalty. If someone killed my family, I would think I would still be against the death penalty. You would never know. But that is a lawyer's trick. We are nation states. We are standing for values. We used to be standing for something. And so for you to make that kind of argument, well, you can't argue that argument. You will always win that argument because it's an emotional argument. And it makes perfect sense, Bill. I mean, it's of course it makes sense. How would you say, I want you that if I had your kid and I was going to kill your kid, that you would sit there and just start burning my toes off one by one? Of course you would. Of course you would. And so when you talk like that way, it feeds people's fears. It feeds their sense of paranoia and fear. And what we did after 9/11 is we based our whole national policy on fear and over-exaggeration. So when you make decisions like that, they usually, I don't know about you, but when I make decisions in my life that are based on fear and anxiety, they almost always blow up in my face. If I make decisions based on thoughtful analysis and some emotion, pretty good. So that is my two cents on that.
Okay.
Simon, I never got my...
Is that really fear or is that righteous indignation? Is it saying, I allow my government to take back or on behalf of a city, you know, again, a big metropolitan city? Do I say, I'm behind the government because they're going to take for this ticking time bomb? You know, that's
okay, fair enough.
I can't argue
with that.
Okay, I'm pretty certain Matthew was trying to break in. Matthew,
I want to just say, because as I said before, I was actually a paratrooper for 4 years, and I was never actually in combat, but I do know that I was in the 82nd Airborne, and is about the 82nd, is that that's a unit that if you fall into their hands, well, you're not going to get treated very well. And in fact, if you go up against the 82nd in any kind of combat situation, we were always told to make sure that, you know, the end result was as convincing as possible. And we always had that reputation, right? So when it came to something like torture, the issue here is not whether torture is right or not, because like that argument about the kids, sure, okay, you need to get the information, but are you torturing the right person? And that's the real argument. These guys are going into houses, and they're told by their commanders, bring somebody back. We need to get some information from somebody. The guys who probably did whatever they're pissed off about are for sure long gone, and they're just going to drag in probably 75% of the cases, somebody that really didn't have much to do with it, except that they had to make a choice between the Americans and, you know, these terrorists that actually live in their neighborhood. So that's my only concern about the torture issue. I think, yeah, if you've got some scumbag and it's war and that's how war goes, yeah, you can torture those guys, but do you have the right guy? And that's the biggest problem with it, and that's where we pissed off the Middle East, because we don't ever get the right guy. We always get the wrong guys. Or not, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that, but too many times we get the wrong guy.
Right. This whole issue about kidnap and ransom. Yeah, the U.S. has a firm policy. We will not negotiate with terrorists. Other countries have a different viewpoint. Certainly Europe likes to get their people back, even if they're journalists that shouldn't have been in the place in the first, to begin with. How does the panel feel about a family wanting to get a loved one back and willing to pay, you know, $200,000 or whatever, and the U.S. government saying, no, if you do that, you're doing something illegal. Who would like to pick up on that subject?
Well, all I can do is echo what Gary said earlier, which is, you know, this is one of the reasons why we have to make decisions based on, you know, policy as a group, and not just decisions by individuals who are affected and they necessarily have a conflict of interest, because it's difficult for them to be able to say what's best for everyone, because they're obviously vested in getting their loved one back. You know, beyond that, I guess I would just have to, I would just have to say that, you know, that's why you can't have the affected individuals making these kinds of policy decisions, because they have a conflict of interest. They, you know, they're impassioned, and they, of course, they will do anything to get their loved one back.
Okay. I'll pick on someone else. Gary, someone kidnaps one of your kids, and they say, I'm a terrorist. Give me $200,000 or else. The government says to you, we don't negotiate with terrorists. You know, we will do our best, but don't give them money. What would you do as a parent?
Well, Simon, if it were me, what would I do is I would do whatever I could to get my family back. But I wouldn't want you to do it. You know, if you want to look at it from a position of not in the moment, but from a global position, if the $200,000 that you would give somebody would be used to buy, you know, all these surface-to-air missiles that would take down an airplane, let's say, and hundreds of people would die. So when you look at it that way, which is the way the governments have to look at it, and the other thing is, if we give money to terrorists who kidnap Americans, what you're going to have is you're going to have a lot of Americans kidnapped. If people know that they're not going to get anything, and the other part of it is it should dissuade your children from going to become a photojournalist in Yemen. Because they're gonna say, you know what, I am taking my risk. So, you know, it's there are so many levers that have to be pushed before I get kidnapped by a terrorist. First of all, I have to be in Afghanistan. I have to be in Pakistan. I have to be in Iraq and Syria. I have to be, you know, in all these places. So all these things happen. Nothing happens in a vacuum. So it's, would I do it? Yes, I would absolutely do it. And would you do it? You would absolutely do it. But I would not want you to do it. If I didn't know you, I would not want you to do it, because it just gives these people all these weapons to do other things and to kill all these other people. That's why nation states have to make this decision, and it can't be anarchy. It can't be you or me deciding this. This is why we have police force, because if someone sits there and punches my kid in the face, do I want to come out with my gun on my hip and go after the person, the neighborhood kid down the street, and somehow get in a confrontation with his family and maybe shoot somebody? No. I want us to call you know, what you could do is take it on a micro level, Simon. If someone goes and disrespects your wife and fields her up at a supermarket, you want to call the police. You don't want to take your gun and go to that person's house and confront them. You just don't want to do that. You want to outsource that as much as you can to people, and you have to hope that your government has some sense.
Oh, I'm in complete agreement. But
okay, can I chime in here too? Sure.
Yes,
sure.
You may.
okay, let's make it a little bit less personal then. What if they kidnap David Cameron, the Prime Minister of England? What do you do there?
Eat him.
What do you, if it's a government, is it? Do you say that the right thing to do is to do everything in everything in your power to get him back? And could that include torture if it was a political? Say they kidnapped Obama, whether you like him or not. Try to get him back through torture. I don't know.
What if they want a nuclear weapon, Bill? What if they want a nuclear weapon? They say, if you want to get Obama back, you have to give us a nuclear weapon. See, you see, what I'm saying is, when you use that kind of argument, you could always get to yes, let's do it. I mean, you could always get to yes. You could always create a scenario where it says yes. But let's say it's not money. Let's say it's uranium, enriched uranium. And they say, we want 5 ounces of enriched uranium, and you get President Obama back. You just can't do that. Money, okay, money is money, but what does money buy? And so it's one of those things where not everyone gets to live. Not everyone has to live. Perhaps the Prime Minister of England will die. Perhaps Obama will die. And believe you me, of course, if that happens, there will be major consequences for the people who did that. But maybe he will die. We just cannot live in a sterile world. We're so afraid. I mean, we're supposed to be a Christian nation, a nation that believes in the afterlife and all this stuff, but we're so terrified of the idea of death that it just freaks people out to this incredible overreaction that people bathe themselves in antibacterial stuff. God forbid they get a germ. It's just always what we do in this country is we use a guillotine for a headache. And you just can't do that. So, Bill, you answer my question. What if Obama was captured and the people in ISIL said, we want 5 ounces of enriched uranium? Now, you tell me, Bill, what would you do?
I would think that I would be in favor of them doing torture techniques to try to find him. I wouldn't give him the uranium. And I guess then, I guess you get in that kind of position as a leader that you need to be willing to die for your country, and maybe that's the bottom line. I was trying to keep it as non-emotional as possible, but maybe that's it. Maybe when senators get elected office, it's like you understand you could die. I mean, maybe we've lost sight of that, and you bring up a good point. I'm not sure it's a Christian issue or not. I'm just saying, are you willing to die for your country, and that people who just get into political office are just as expendable and as important as the military. I mean, maybe that's the, maybe we've lost sight of that.
Okay, Matthew, you mentioned that you were part of the 82nd Airborne. You were prepared to die for your country, correct?
Yep, I lived with that for 4 years. And can I point something out here?
Sure.
I think Obama's chances of surviving that kidnapping actually decreased significantly with a Republican Congress. So that would be my thing. And the other thing is, this is so crazy because it was a bill, I think, in New Jersey said something about sociopaths. And I have a little mini blog called Wisdom of the Ages, and today's was called Congress and Prisons. And it says one is full of sociopathic criminals, and the other is full of people who couldn't find a good sociopathic criminal to defend them. So, and then there's Bill talking about sociopaths. So I'm sorry, what was your question, Simon?
I love it. Matthew, welcome to the show. You're going to fit in great here.
Well, thank you. I'd love to.
Welcome.
Be back.
Welcome. You're going to do great.
You so just got to be fairly thick skinned.
Don't worry.
Today has just been a warm up.
The very most important thing about this show is that you have an opinion. It doesn't matter how well you can support it, but you got to have an opinion, and I love it. I think it's great. You support your opinion very well. I don't mean to suggest to the contrary, but we just want to hear.
Well, the thing about my opinions is they're always correct, and that's the nice thing about them.
No, Lord.
Oh, I'm sorry, Simon. What you asked me something I completely forgot.
No, I was laughing at your comment. Oh, and by the way, San Fran now has a 7-3 lead.
Oh.
Hey, now, Matthew, is this you? Wisdom of the Ages, quote a day with filters. Is that you?
What's with filters? I don't know.
I don't know.
Filters.
I just went on Wisdom of the Ages, just trying to see if I could find your whatever it is.
It should be on Twitter. It's on Twitter, Google Plus.
All right, all right. Next time. I'll track it down.
Okay. Yes, Simon, give me some email addresses. I'll add these people to my thing. I send them out every day. Yesterday, my Wisdom of the Ages was small towns where everybody knows your name and your driving record.
Oh, you need to get Sam on the show. Come on now. That's a Mafiaism if ever there was one.
Sam will be back next week, and I see this as a marriage made in heaven.
Good thing it wasn't me in Cleveland.
I think Cleveland got spanked today.
They did indeed.
Oh,
the Battle of Ohio was lost.
Oh, such a shame. I'll be talking to him tomorrow, and I'll mention it. I'll tell him that the entire team offers their commiserations. And he'll probably abuse me. So I'm looking at the clock. We're getting dangerously close to the end. So I'd like to go once around the clock, or once around the members, and get your final thoughts. Not fair, but I'm going to start with Matthew. You're the new kid on the block. You've been blooded. What do you think of today's topics?
Well, thanks a lot for having me on the show, and you guys, it's really nice listening to you guys, your awesome intelligence. I did take issue with somebody saying just a teacher at some point, but other than that, I think I'm going to be okay with it. Again, I am a high school teacher. I taught English in the Middle East for the last 13 years, and now I've just finished publishing a book, and I'd love to be back. It's really nice talking to you guys. And Simon, I really appreciate you having me on here. And Simon, I don't know if you can, but if you could share my website with people or something, I don't know if that's possible.
I will indeed. Don't worry about that. And let's go to Los Angeles. Gary.
Yeah.
Your wrap-up thoughts for us.
Simon, it was fun. Bill, it was fun. I was happy to hear from Bill more today. It's always good. He was he stood in the ring, and he was able to give as good as he got. So that was good. He actually brought up some terrific points that I liked. And it's always good to have Peter on board, because I just feel like sometimes I'm just a dingleberry on the political life, and I need a fellow, someone to help me out here. So thank you, Peter and Matthew. Good to hear from you, and I hope all is well.
And Peter, I guess that means you get last bite of the cherry.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and quite frankly, today I everybody said something that I found myself very much in agreement with at different points in time, and I'm grateful for the discussion, and as I always say, you know, maybe we solved one or two problems today. We've got a lot more to go. We're never going to run out of them. That's for sure. That's my opinion. Thanks. Thanks to everybody.
And
welcome, Matthew.
Thank you.
This is Simon Barrett. Wishing everyone a happy, healthy, safe, and dry week. We'll be back next Sunday. Till then, goodbye.